This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
What Mr. Scamander fears above everything else is...
having to work in an office, sir.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Right, let's see how far I can push this bit. Today, we are looking at The Botanist's Guide to Citrus Fruit, Fantastic Vitamin C's, and The Limes of Grindelwald. No, we are actually looking at the London Underground Musical Appendix, Fantastic Beats and the Grimes of Grindelwald. What else have we got? Fantastic Seas and the Brines of Grindelwald. No, it is, of course, Fantastic Trees, the Pines of Grindelwald. Or Fantastic Teas, the Behinds of Grindelwald. He has multiple. No, obviously, we are continuing on from last week's episode with Fantastic Beasts and the Crimes of Grindelwald. We'll go over some news first, tell you a little bit about this quote-unquote movie, our thoughts, and then discuss some of the creatures, including Antonio the Chupacabra, somehow?
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah. The Kelpie, the...
Zou.
Close enough for an idiot like me, yeah.
Yes.
And then the Matago. We're assuming that's Matago and not Matagot or Matagot or something like that.
You never know.
Yeah. And then Libby will talk a little bit about exposition in a story and exposition dumps in general. And then Adam has a section just on dumps as well.
They're important. You should have one a day at least. I could be wrong, but you want to be regular. Eat oats. Fiber.
Yep.
sounds like someone who's not regular.
But before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist, the writer, short story soup, bruv. Allow it. And,
In it, bruv.
Perfect.
And last but not least, we are joined by Dave, who's back this week, a vet and our movie physiologist. So,
hey, Dave.
In a bit of personal news this week, we know that it was Earth Week, about a week ago by the time this episode comes out, but I was on the Earth Day Live Twitch stream, I believe is what the kids call it, and it's referred to, being interviewed by, somewhat prescient to this week's episode, Bonnie Wright, aka Ginny Weasley. I tried not to bring that up during the entire interview because, you know, I'm sure she gets that all the time. But yeah,
I'm sure she appreciated it.
Yeah, we had a chat about Scope 3 emissions, the IPCC report, systemic change and individual change and what we can do to, you know, fight against climate change, which is obviously very important given some of the news that we've talked about the last couple of weeks. So yeah, that was a lot of fun, and we will have a link to it in the episode description if you want to go and check it out.
Please do. Yeah, also relating to Earth Day, some actual good news coming out of our home country, the United States of America. For Earth Day, President Biden signed an executive order that basically aimed to strengthen America's forests, boosting wildlife resilience, and to help combat global deforestation. There were a lot of actions to this and a lot of different components, but kind of the long and short of it was this will safeguard mature and old-growth forests that are on federal lands, which is a very important part of our ecosystem. This will help strengthen reforestation efforts across the country, combat global deforestation in general, and try to enlist nature to address the climate crisis. And this might, I think, the goal of that is to use these forest measures as carbon sinks in the future. Finally, the government doing something good. Ooh. With the only good thing the U.S. has, which is its natural, which is nature.
Yeah. I guess they're finally at the point where they can start, you know, actually making progress as opposed to just undoing all the shit that Trump brought in.
Yeah, I mean, that's the usual cycle. About half of your term just spent trying to course correct what happened last time, and then whoever's next after Biden, unless it's him again, it'll just be the same thing.
Yeah.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife staff in North Carolina welcomed a litter of 6 red wolf pups today.
Woo!
It's the first time in 4 years that a pair of wild red wolves gave birth to a litter in the wild.
Red wolves are really interesting, actually. There's been a lot of debate over whether or not they should even be conserved because they're thought to be hybrids between coyotes and grey wolves. So it's just like, if they're hybrids, are we actually doing a disservice to the grey wolves and the coyotes? But in recent years, it's shown that there's a lot of like lost genetic DNA from coyotes still extant in red wolves, which I think is really cool. So I definitely think they're worth conserving. Just, I mean, just for their cultural value alone, right? Adam and Libby, they're really culturally important in the US, yeah.
I can't speak to that too much. I hadn't heard of red wolves until I moved to Arkansas when I was in high school. And that was the mascot of the local university, because they thankfully changed it from a very unfriendly un-PC name taken from an indigenous group. They're now the Red Wolves, and I then learned what a Red Wolf was. So
they are down south, right? You don't get Red Wolves up in Canada, Dave?
No, generally speaking, not that I know of.
Yeah, the last little bit of news, again, USA-centric, so apologies to our non-American listeners, all five of you. We talked about Animal Crossing, specifically for carnivores, in a recent episode on The Monster. And in Southern California, in a small town called Los Angeles, people might have heard of it. They're about...
Heard of it.
Maybe.
I think it's like Spanish or something like that.
Whale's vagina.
Yeah, that's the one. They're creating a massive overpass over Highway 101, which I've been told is like an enormous sprawling highway that dominates a lot of northern LA. And this is right in the heart of mountain lion territory as well. So it'll be a huge boost for their populations to now be able to cross over this previously pretty much impenetrable barrier.
And for any of those who have seen just how ridiculous US highways and overpasses can get, tend to think of yourself trying to cross one of these on foot and how challenging that might be. And now think of an animal who doesn't understand cars and highways.
Yeah. We said last time, putting just a simple road can like block off a lot of creatures. A 10-lane fucking highway. Like that's,
looks like a Mario Kart racetrack.
Yeah.
That never doesn't have traffic on it.
Oh, that's
exactly
grotesque.
They had a 50-year-old Colorado man who set himself on fire in front of the White House, and it looks like it was a Earth Day protest. They're still working through all the details, but he posted something a year ago saying that he was going to do this in support of Earth Day to like show the world what it was like to burn.
I haven't even heard about that.
Fuck, yeah, I'm looking at it now. Colorado man sets himself on fire on Supreme Court steps in D.C. Jesus Christ.
50 years old, yeah.
Hey everyone, just a quick note, as we said last week and as we're going to say again next week, we are going to be joking a little bit about Rowling and some of her views today, but in all seriousness, we do want to let people know that we stand with trans people worldwide. We have deep sympathy with the suffering that many of you have to go through on a daily basis, and we absolutely stand against Rowling and many of her ilk's views on transphobia and trans people in general. We hear a lot that basic biology says that trans people don't exist. That's absolute crap. Advanced biology tends to disagree with you.
For this week's summary of Fantastic Beasts, The Trying Times of Grindelwald, I just drew a picture of a maze with no solution, because that to me has more clarity than this movie's plot. Though this is the second in a trilogy about Newt Scamander, we understand fully through this movie that these movies will no longer be about him or magical beasts, despite its title. Rather, we are left with the deep need for most of these characters to go through some sort of communication and relationship therapy, as every single problem we encounter could be solved with about a 5-minute conversation. This movie is all about what happens when a bunch of adults act like children. Lita lets a childhood mistake turn fatal accident turn secret to impact her and the lives of everyone around her negatively. Queenie would rather rape the person she loves and join a eugenics-loving Civil War leader rather than respect someone's decision about marriage. Tina causes unnecessary drama by avoiding a respectful conversation that would clear up a simple misunderstanding about Newt being engaged. Credence neglects and abandons the woman who actually loves him in search of literally anyone else who will love him, because he was abandoned as a baby. And last but not least, Dumbledore himself, who seemingly knows most all secrets at any given time, would rather lead people to their own discovery rather than just tell people what he knows, as seen funnily enough by the title of the third movie.
That about sums it up, I'd say.
Let's try and bring this into a what's the opposite of a compliment sandwich? A negativity sandwich, and have a little section on what
we... Shit salad.
A shit salad, yeah. What did we like about this movie? Do people have things? I'll start. I like Jude Law as Dumbledore. I like Dumbledore. I think he's really good. I think he's got some charisma. I think he is what Richard Harris would have been if Richard Harris wasn't
8 million years old.
Yeah, in the first two Harry Potter films.
Yeah.
And he just had a bit of kindness to him that I thought Michael Gambon's Dumbledore didn't. That's all I've got, yeah.
Don't you mean manic depressive Dumbledore?
Yeah.
Asshole Dumbledore. Yeah.
As with last week, Jacob Kowalski still killing it. Newt Scamander still a delight, but yeah, they're not in it enough. So, oh, and I like the salamander, the eyes of a salamander joke.
That was pretty good. Yeah. Antonio, what a cutie! Dislike the betrayal of Antonio
out the fucking window with him. Jesus,
oh my God, I was so sad. He was so cute. I liked when this movie didn't take itself too seriously. The moments of levity can be really fun and, like, sweet. They were just obviously a little too far in between. And I honestly liked Nicholas Flamel. I think Adam might feel a little differently on this, but I really liked the introduction of a character that we kind of were familiar with and exploring his lore and background. And it was just fun seeing that character kind of brought back in a way. Yeah. But I needed more of him.
Don't look a day over 130.
Like Sam, I like Jude Law's Dumbledore. It's just that he definitely has that. He conveys that cleverness, the twinkle in the eye of, like, I know something you don't, but I'm not going to be a dick about it. Unless you really read into it. Kowalski, great as always. I very much enjoy Newt's Commander as a character. Yep.
I always like seeing Thestrals in any of the Harry Potter movies. I know we won't be talking about them today. The Death Horses, they're always great. They're a fantastic part of Harry Potter lore. I enjoyed seeing them in this film.
Yeah. And I thought that was kind of a fun scene, but as with all of the other scenes in this movie, it makes no fucking sense if you think about it for more than a second.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nope.
So yeah, moving on to what we didn't like. This movie had so much happening in it, and at the same time, nothing at all. Queenie's motivations, particularly for leaving Jacob, like, she's like, okay, I can't marry you, but this man who hates everything you represent, I'm going to go and follow him because he's going to allow me to marry you?
To keep you as a pet?
Yeah. They keep doing, like, remember this, like the Nicholas Flamel thing, so many other, like, oh, we're at Hogwarts, you know Hogwarts, you're at Hogwarts, this is a Lestrange, remember her? Lestrange, that's her name, that was in the movie. Like, just stop. Dumbledore's in this, that's all you need. People fucking love Dumbledore. Just
and McGonagall.
In the movie. Yeah, and but McGonagall was another example of that, like, McGonagall, yeah? So she's aged really well as well, too, because she must be like
they both have.
And the last thing is, there is an expo dump scene in this where both Yusuf Karma and Leta Lestrange talk for like 10 to 12 minutes. Just
real time.
Yeah, just straight up spinning fucking fables. And they're not particularly engaging ones either. The most gratuitous expo dumps I've ever seen in a movie.
Also, in the scene before that, they were in the French Ministry of Magic, more on that later, and Leta Lestrange is wearing, like, a normal business day outfit. They're in the tomb, all of a sudden she's wearing, like, a sexy nightie with her hair down. Where did her hat go? Why did she change? Why is she wearing bedclothes? What the fuck happened between these scenes?
I have a theory about that. Well, obviously the story is atrocious as a whole. I felt really bad for Nagini's poor character. I think I read in trivia that she literally only had 5 lines this entire script. I felt for her. I felt bad for her as a character. I felt bad for her as an actor. I don't understand what they were doing with her other than just, we'll just leave it at that. Yeah, my least favorite is Leta's Hodor moment. Dying to let, quote, Newt and Theseus escape, except they stand there and don't escape, really. Same with Hodor and Game of Thrones. It was just a completely pointless death scene. And that brings back to my theory, Adam, is that I think Leta just wanted to kill herself. I think she had this whole thing where she, like, got her secret off her chest, and she was obviously feeling very, like, conflicted. You know, they were hinting at it, conflicted feelings about being in love with Newt and being in love with his brother. And so I think she knew it. And so that's why she changed into, like, her goodbye outfit.
That's dark as fuck.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Like this movie, which feels dark even when they're in broad daylight. Very odd. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, minus the literally one million plot issues with this movie, this movie has gone from, this universe has gone from a universe of a school, an alley in London, and the mention of two other schools, now to, they've been to the US, which felt a bit more real, but then they go to Paris to the French Ministry of Magic, after touching on the American Ministry of Magic. That's like if I went to Australia and said, I'm going to go to the Australian White House, and I'm going to go to Canada and go to the Canadian White House. Like, nothing in the US would be called the Ministry of Magic. I don't think they'd be calling it the French Ministry of Magic if they're in France. It's so fucking lazy and stupid, and I mean, at least in the first movie, you have MACUSA, the magic wizard. Sorry, the Magical Congress of the United States of America. That is what a magic American organization would call itself. Also, my biggest issue with this movie, that is what came up when I first watched it, that I was pretty alarmed no one else ever talked about, Queenie's whole backstory of being totally okay straight up raping Jacob for who knows how long, just so she could have a family and get what she wants. That's fucked up. And if they had actually gone in on that, it would have made a lot more sense that she's a villain. But even with that horrible, horrible thing she did, they don't touch on it, it doesn't relate to the story, and no one talks about it. So that really fucks me off.
Yeah, this kind of concept has been made a joke of before. I mean, they talk about love potions in the Harry Potter universe, which is horrifying. And Fred and George are shown to sell those at their fucking store. Yep. Their brother almost gets taken advantage of in that way. Like,
he did get taken advantage of in that way.
Yeah, he almost died. I mean, not because of the love potion, but in the end, like, the whole incident almost caused him to die. Like,
also slavery. They, like, mention it briefly in the books, apparently, which I still haven't read it, so I don't know. But, like, in the movies, yeah, they make it, like... It's not just the Malfoys that have a slave. Like,
yeah. No, the house elves are everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The school has them.
Hermione goes on this big thing to release the house elves, and they make her seem like she's a fucking, like, a nut job, like a loose unit. Just a loose unit. Like, she's in there getting fucking smashed with the house elves every day, real fucking loose unit.
Like a punch and darts.
Yeah, they make her seem like she's got a screw loose. That's the expression I was going for. When she's trying to free slaves.
Also, the whole part of, like, the original universe of the original movies is the separation of the magical world from the non-magical world. In this movie, they're doing magic in public, left, right, front, and fucking center. The entrance to the French Ministry of Magic is literally a fountain that trees grow around, and you go into, and then you sink into the ground. The entrance to the they probably call it French Diagonale. That one is literally a post in the middle of a fucking stairwell next to a cafe. Everyone's going to see you go into this.
Yeah, but muggles, they don't see nothing, do they?
No, the non-magique.
The non-magique, the non-mage. The can't spell. That was bad. That fucking...
Can't spell. That was my favorite.
The can't spell, yeah.
I fully agree with everything you guys said, but just to go in a slightly different direction, because Adam was like, I'm going to avoid the nitpicking, but I enjoy the Harry Potter fans nitpicking against this film. Accio cannot be used on animate objects. It can't be used for living creatures. And yet we see Newt summoning Niffler. Like, that's a huge point in the movies. It's a huge point in the books. And he's just like, nah, that's fine.
And Rowling wrote this movie too. So how did she fuck that up?
I have a nitpick for your nitpick. He not only uses it on the Niffler, he uses it to move the Niffler from one place to another, not to summon it. And it's a summoning spell.
And then my absolute favorite part that the fans rag on all the time is that we are repeatedly told that Grindelwald finishes his schooling at Durmstrang. Why does he have a British accent?
Maybe he's learned English really well. Like, you know, that
Maybe
is...
Maybe he picked the accent up?
He probably lived in Britain for a while. I had a Norwegian friend who never lived in London before and had a perfect, like, posh British accent. And this guy's very smart, so he potentially could pick that up.
Swedish friend I know who was in Glasgow for her bachelor's has a Scottish accent in English.
Yeah, and I've met one of Adam's Dutch friends who has the most absurd, like, southern US accent mixed with the Dutch.
She is all over the place. She's lived too many places. It's really fucked up her English.
Do we all remember the scars that were forming over top of the hands of all of the Death Eaters in the Harry Potter movies? Do you remember how they talked
the
about
scars the scars of the dark mark tattoo on their forearm?
Oh, you remember the Dark Mark tattoo, yeah. But do you remember all the scars that form secondary to the use of unbreakable vows? It doesn't form any, like, scar material. There's nothing that you can, like, track it in the books or the movie originally.
Yeah, that makes sense, because then they'd know that Snape had made a fucking...
Exactly! Yeah, okay. Because then they'd fucking know! You would literally just flip the arm over and go, oh, you have an unbreakable vow working on you. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Maybe the technology's progressed. Maybe they've got, like, skin grafts they can put over the top of the unbreakable vow.
Don't give any credit to this hollow-ass universe.
No, it's just like, I need to get these term papers in on time, so I made unbreakable vows with all my students.
Totally bad.
And for anybody who's getting angry that we're hating on this so much, go back and listen to last week's episode. We love the first one. Well, Adam and I love the first one, so yeah.
Yep, saw it three times in theaters.
Ginny, these must be for you.
It's ghastly.
Nicholas, a little bit of trivia. Nicholas Flamel, for those who don't know, was an actual historical French scribe and manuscript seller. So, shocking no one, Rowling completely lifted this character from history and didn't even bother changing their name.
Why would she?
After the actual Nicholas Flamel's death, he developed a reputation as an alchemist, believed to have discovered the Philosopher's Stone and thereby achieved immortality. So he has since then appeared as a legendary alchemist in various fictional works, including this one.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of interesting. Like, if anybody's seen Only Lovers Left Alive, John Hurt in that movie plays Christopher Marlowe, a renowned English playwright, who is just revealed to be a vampire the entire time. And so I think that, you know, Nicholas Flamel being part of the Wizarding World, I think that's kind of interesting.
It makes sense.
Other bit of trivia is Cal Turner, who plays Theseus, and Eddie Redmayne, who plays Newt, grew up less than 100 meters from each other, and their childhood homes in Chelsea, London are literally a three-minute walk from one another. They weren't friends, but they experienced many milestone memories in the same places, such as learning to swim in the same pool.
Huh. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think there was a cute little interview, too, where basically Callum Turner was like, we were meant to be brothers.
Yeah. We have this very, very odd thing that without ever having met each other, we grew up 100 meters from each other.
So, before we start looking at these creatures today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, as always, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hassick Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also find us on Discord. You can find the link to our server in the episode description or on the website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a ceaseless discharge of short stories. And if you want to hear about some of them... yes, thank Libby, that is the correct face to make. Yeah. If you want to hear about some of the... less movie-related ecological science that Adam, myself, and a massive team of international writers write about, check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode or any others, feel free to leave us an in-app rating, preferably of the five-star variety. The first beast we see in this movie, Antonio, he's supposed to be a chupacabra.
No, he fucking isn't.
There's no way.
Yeah, would the Americans among us like to explain what a chupacabra is?
Not that.
So if any of our listeners who speak Spanish will know, chupacabra literally means goat sucker, and it's from the parts of the U.S., and I think originally Mexico itself, but the parts of the states in the U.S. that border Mexico, so Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, those places, and it is a monster that is usually kind of seen as a small reptilian-looking man, usually bipedal, though I think sometimes they're quadrupeds, usually frilly scales along the head and the spinal regions, big red glowing eyes, sharp teeth, and they eat livestock, usually goats, hence capra.
I think they also said that it's typically supposed to stand and hop in a similar fashion to a kangaroo.
Huh. Yeah, okay. That's one of the backgrounds to them, or one of the stories.
Yeah,
but yeah, they're small, not as small as Antonio is, and they have four appendages, not the six that Antonio seems to have. Yeah. Who looks more like a Dodongo from the Legend of Zelda video game series than he does,
or even just a
chupacabra.
Or even just a bearded dragon. Like, he looks way more like that than a chupacabra.
Yeah. To me, this thing is exactly like a thorny devil, basically. If you look up thorny devil online, there is even a photo which looks almost exactly like the way that Johnny Depp holds up Antonio to himself. It's wonderful. Yeah, and Dave's talked about very close, not close relatives, but a species which is very similar, or a group of species which is very similar to thorny devils, which is horny toads or horned toads or horned toads.
They're so cool.
Yeah, they're not related to thorny devils at all. It's just kind of convergent evolution. But essentially, and Dave, you've talked about this before, so just fill me in where I go wrong. The thorns, the spikes that cover thorny devils have two purposes. One of them is that they predators think twice before they chomp down on them.
It looks scary.
And the other thing, which is really cool, is that the contours of the body enable any water that forms on the skin to, like, be channeled down, like, straight towards the mouth. So,
which is so cool.
Yeah, it's an amazing method of getting water in, like, a really water-sparse environment, like a desert. So, Antonio is clearly a desert creature.
Poor thing, thrown to these rainy and stormy streets of New York.
Yeah.
Literally into the New York Harbor.
Yeah, so probably going to drown or overhydrate or something like that.
The entire movie. Absolutely.
He's got more of a kind of a frog or a chameleon tongue, though. Dave, you've talked about, like, frog and chameleon tongues before. Is that one just a little too large?
I mean, it's within the normal limits as to what we would expect. I don't have any concerns with the anatomy of our little friend other than whipping him into the darkness below.
Yeah.
It's what we... is colloquially known as a dick move.
Yeah. In the wizard world, that's what it's called. In our world, I think we have something different for it.
Most modern scholars think that chupacabras, in fact, were just coyotes with scabies in terms of the reduced hair coat, the thickening of skin. They didn't look anything like the reptile. It was just a group of ranchers.
Yeah.
Right, seeing a hairless, mangy-looking dog and going, ah, fucking monster!
Yeah.
And even they weren't whipping it into the darkness below. I mean, they did terrible things, but still.
I kept waiting for him to, like, be magicked into Grindelwald's pocket or something. And the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's what's about to happen. And then about halfway through the movie, you realize, oh, he's just gone.
Yeah.
And the exact thing happened again when I watched it this time. Like, oh, he's got his little pet, guy like Antonio.
Yeah.
He threw him out because he's going to save him here in a second. Oh, no. He's definitely dead again.
Yeah. And also, there's no need for that extra pair of legs. Like, it doesn't really...
Extra energy, extra material.
Yeah.
Maybe they were swimming legs.
Yeah. The other thing I want to say about the thorny devil, which is really cool, is that they have this kind of bulbous growth on the back of their neck, which is just soft flesh. It's like a second head, like it wards off predators because they think it's looking at them. I think that should have been on Antonio. I think that would have been fun.
It's giving an extra face, like Quirrell.
Yeah, giving him a literal extra head. And I think that would have been, that would have been interesting.
Child, why have you come here?
Multi-bear, I seek your head! Or one of them, anyway. There's like, what, six heads?
This is foolish!
A species that is a little closer to its mythological background is the Kelpie, which we see early in the film that Newt's taken care of in his underground pool, lake?
Underwater chamber, aqueduct, reservoir, Scottish loch.
Part of the Scottish Highlands, stuck in this, like, underground
cellar. A briefcase?
Yeah. The Kelpie, again, is a creature from us, I think, Celtic mythology. And, I mean, the concept of a horse-like creature adapting to the water, I mean, that's not crazy. That's very close to how we got hippos and whales. Whippomorphs and cetaceans were, well, they still are. They're artiodactyls, which is, you know, the same family as rhinos, deer, anything like that. So, perissodactyls, which horses belong to, the concept of, you know, a species in that family adapting to the water, not a problem at all. And this does have the up and down movement in its swimming that it would when a mammal adapts to the water. The weird thing here, though, is that the camouflage sort of stuff, the kelp that's got all over its body, which makes it a literal kelpie, I think somebody, you know, took that description the wrong way. But... It could serve two purposes. It could be an ambush predator, which would mean that it is, like the Kelpie of myth, a carnivore. But I don't know if that makes...
And a very dangerous one at that.
Yeah. This is... Mm-hmm. a species that, I don't know, I think it would make a lot more sense for them just to be aquatic grazers. Because, I mean, you have had sloths and, I mean, moose still do it today. Moose still graze on algae underwater. They'll go swimming. And sometimes they even get chomped up by orcas. So for a species to just take that to the next level, like hippos have done, that makes total sense.
And manatees, right? They're big seagrass grazers.
I think it makes more sense for it to be a carnivore. When you've had these artiodactyls, these horse-like, or even in the case of whales and other cetaceans, wolf-like ancestors move from the surface or the land to the water, they are specializing as carnivores. And then the bigger whales being filter feeders, the smaller cetaceans such as orcas and dolphins usually being a, you know, a more bite and chew type carnivore. And this type of kelp, although it would suit it more to be in Southern California in those huge kelp forests, yeah, where you see the sea otters living, this would be a great sea otter predator because it would blend right the fuck in until the sea otter got way too close. Unless this, I mean, even if it has to go up and breathe air and doesn't have gills, which I don't think it would as a mammal, because this is definitely a mammal, it could still be underwater for a long period of time.
I was just going to say, I think from a story and mythology point of view, I really like the idea of the kelpie being a carnivore, because in, you know, history, that's what they were. Yep. And it's said that they often use shape-shifting as well to, like, trick people into the water. So they would, like, shift into a person to lure usually young women to their deaths.
Yeah. See, I think that makes more sense. The other option is that they are in need of camouflage. Because it looks a lot like a species we have in Australia called the leafy sea dragon. Dave's talked about in the Aquaman episode, you did a section on how fucking useless seahorses are. Sea dragons are very closely related to seahorses.
They're so cute.
Yeah, and sea dragons look like seahorses, but they just have like a lot more kind of leafy appendages coming off them. Because that's all they have. Like, they have camouflage as their only line of defense. That is it. Those appendages and that kind of decoration for the sake of camouflage, that reminds me a lot of what we see in the kelpie, but that implies that there are predators in Scottish lochs large enough to trouble the kelpie, which we know there aren't, unless, you know, Loch Ness monsters were a magical creature that died out at some point. If it was a marine species hanging around in kelp forests, it would have the double positive of you can be an ambush predator and you can hide from larger predators. Like, I guess you could get orcas around that area, right?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Something similar to that.
Yeah, but I think it being a carnivore that, you know, ambushes otters or seals from kelp forests makes more sense. Yeah. So, I mean, understandable because, you know, Bunty gets a nasty bite from it and Newt is obviously quite wary of the creature.
And rightfully so.
Yeah.
It got him. Ate him like it was some sort of animal.
So, next up we have the Chinese tiger dragon cat monster, the Zhou, which is, again, straight up a ripoff of a Chinese mythological beast that they made some slight changes to with the addition of the big frilly tail, at least for this specific incarnation of this monster. But Newt talks about this creature being able to run 1,000 miles a day, which is quite the ordeal for any organism, especially one that size that is literally running all the time. But in a lot of ways, I feel like, minus the magical properties that are inherent to a creature like this, it's not too far-fetched of an organism. Just some slightly more exaggerated features from a couple of different organisms put together into one clearly carnivorous organism. It looks like a giant tiger with longer, almost more squamate or reptilian legs to the side of its body instead of underneath.
Well, it's overly, like, because the back legs, I checked the back legs, and they look more mammalian.
That's weird. I didn't even notice them.
A couple of times it does stand upright with its legs under its body, but it seems to choose to kind of, like, stalk along to its prey. So I think that there's just, like, a history of climbing at some point, and it can go between the two.
I can see that.
And cats are incredibly flexible, and depending on, I think we've talked about this before, one of the coolest words, at least in veterinary medicine, that we get to use is the term syncsarcosis, which is the idea that dog and cat limbs actually are not connected to the rest of the skeleton for their front limbs. They're connected by a series of muscle and the interconnected nerves that basically connect down the limb themselves. Cats have a false clavicle in terms of what's attached. So if this is just an increased flexibility where they're able to maneuver and shift these limbs down their body using a center of muscle, totally reasonable. It would make their weight rather difficult when it came to spreading that out, but yeah. It's definitely something that we could consider.
I like that.
But that tail is absurd. Like, that would be such a hindrance in so many things.
Yeah. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with the peacock, and if you're not, it is the very bright, very colorful, very loud bird that has an enormous group of tail feathers that I would say make up 90% of its body, not by weight, but just by sheer length and kind of general area this creature to this animal takes up. Think a big chicken with a crazy beautiful tail feather, because that's basically what they are. And this kind of tail, and in the real world, those feathers on a peacock are what we call, an example of what we call runaway selection, or in this case, runaway sexual selection. This being the case where selection for a trait, and it's usually because of sexual selection, whereby a female will favor a male with a certain level or a certain exaggerated showy trait. With the peacocks, it's that big showy tail feather spread. With the zoo, it is the, we're assuming, this massively floral pink back half of its body, tail potentially. And these just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, because even though they're not going to be the most useful for everyday life and be, as Sam put it, a hindrance and too much to deal with, because the females like it, it is selected for. And because it's selected for, it will stay in the population over time, especially if it's heritable, I should say. But we're assuming that this is heritable. The females, we're assuming this is a male and the female, because this is usually what happens in the natural world. The males are showy, the females are choosy. And yeah, this tail is going to be enormously expensive from a metabolic standpoint. It's probably not that easy to deal with. If you've seen videos or heard about deer getting stuck in the woods because their antlers, their rack is way too big, the females like a showy rack, so they get them. But it's really hard for those males to make their way through the forest with it.
Yeah.
And hence we end Adam's explanation on the dangers of having too big a rack.
I do have an alternate scientific explanation for this tale from a non-scientist.
Okay. I don't think you're qualified to make these sort of statements.
I am sick of all you guys ganging up on me. You guys all think you're so much better than me.
Oh, Meg, that is the least fancy thing I have ever heard.
Okay, so we're back now. We've had a little conference with Libby, and we've decided she is allowed to tell this story.
Or rather, I'll tell it, and if it's good enough, you'll edit it out and then present it as your own.
Yeah.
Give it that typical male voice.
Everybody put their monocles on.
This creature, which I'm not going to pronounce his name incorrectly, was obviously very mistreated and kept in a circus. So I wager that this is some sort of sheep's wool situation. You know, that sheep's wool keeps, certain species of sheep at least, keep growing indeterminately unless you shear them. So I think the tail is some sort of indeterminate growth of hair or feathers or whatever the fuck it's made out of, that has been neglected and not very well maintained by the, clearly abusive circus owner.
Okay. So it could be like a case of, like a domesticated breed that is bred for massive tail size but you're supposed to be cutting it.
Or a species, as Libby brings up, that maybe in the wild, with frequent exposure, depending on its territory, the hair does get torn off or removed or brushed free, depending on what it's moving through. And now it's just simply stuck in a cage, letting overgrowth take place. It's a good idea.
I like the theory of the poor treatment. I think the only issue with that is that the bright coloration suggests that it is meant to be some kind of showy trait, especially given that the rest of the organism seem to be "" in okay shape. But maybe those teeth should have been not quite growing out of its mouth like it was.
They're almost tusks.
Growing too much.
Last
story about this, because we're talking about something that is not necessarily useful, but I want to talk about a really cool experiment of something that is useful, but just never came about. So Adam and I had a professor who was a complete wanker during our masters, and he told us about this fantastic experiment where they basically just attached an extra red feather to a species of brown bird's tail on the males. And checked reproductive success after a while, and they found that the birds that they'd attached the red feather to were much more successful at getting the ladies. So, I mean, it goes to show what Adam always talks about regards to evolution. It's just what works at the time, but it's also just chance. Because, I mean, obviously evolving a red feather would be incredibly beneficial, but it's just never happened. That mutation has never surfaced. Just because something is beneficial doesn't mean it's going to turn up.
Exactly. Or just because something is maybe detrimental doesn't mean it won't be selected for and stay in the population. See enormous racks and peacock feathers.
And as I'm sure all of the other birds said to the bird with the red feather, you're just fucking new. That's the only reason she's paying attention to you. You'll wear out your welcome eventually and she'll realize you're just like the rest of us.
Especially when there's more of you. The novelty's worn off. You ain't no goddamn trendsetter. Obviously, the Zau is shown to be absolutely transfixed and just stop dead because of this tiny little toy, which I think is kind of a funny moment in the movie. Dave, would that be possible with any species?
I mean, it would be possible with a cat. It would potentially be chemical induced. The closest comparison I can get is catnip. In terms of, we still don't fully understand exactly the mechanisms by which the chemical associated with catnip and nepetalosone actually causes the changes we see with cats. We used to think it was, for the longest time, it was a vomeronasal organ response, but we do know that when cats are exposed to it, it leads to an alteration in their behavior. It leads to sort of a weird shift. They will oftentimes hypersalivate and repeatedly push themselves against that sort of object. If he's got some sort of chemical-induced concoction that he's basically releasing and the cat just gets there and it's like, oh yeah, fuck, I could get high. That'd be fine. Yeah, I'm down for that. All right, cool. Yeah, it's been a really bad couple of years. Yeah. I need this. I really need this right now. Right. I do enjoy that idea that he's just carrying around a pocket full of catnip basically at any point.
Fun fact, mint, as in the plant mint, is a cousin of catnip. And so a lot of cats will also behave the same way with mint.
Really?
My sister's cat used to sneak in her purse and eat not only her chewing gum, but her menthol cigarettes.
Snack time!
And then the last species is the Matagu. I'm assuming that's how you pronounce it. If it's French, which is a spirit familiar, and J.K. Rowling has said that there's no such things as familiars in the Harry Potter universe. So another nice little example of people not quite thinking these through, despite the fact that she was the one who apparently wrote this movie. They're really well-trained cats, it seems like. And you guys are all cat owners, so I'm sure you knew this, but I was one of these people who was laboring under the delusion that training cats was actually impossible. It's not, but it's harder, right? It's much harder.
I mean, for reference, I have three cats. All three are trained to sit and stay. One of them was trained to do that at 8 years old, another at four, and then another when she was a kitten.
Yeah.
And I think it depends on the level of intelligence the cat has. I think for me to, sorry, as the cat is digging in this hole.
Master cat trainer Libby, everybody.
Exactly.
And I'll say, to train them, I definitely had to use food as a motivation. It's definitely different from the sense of like praise and the praise kind of training that you use with dogs.
Yeah. I found two main reasons. One is that cats respond really poorly to punishment, right? Like they would just hold it against you for a long, long time.
If spite was an animal, it would be a cat.
And the other reason is that, so we've talked about the complicated nuances of the term domestication before. I think when we did Cats, the musical.
Maybe.
But the term domestication is really kind of vague, and there's a lot of gray area there. But what is generally accepted is that dogs are domesticated. However, there's still a lot of debate about whether or not cats are domesticated. We have bred specialized breeds of cats, of course, like the Sphinx cat, which these Matagal look a lot like. But generally, it's so they look a specific way. With dogs, we've been breeding for behaviors, certain types of behavior, which I think... Yeah, which is why we generally consider them a lot more domestic and cats a little more wild. So apparently that's another reason why they're much harder to train, because they're still not quite considered domesticated by some people.
I think another thing is that maybe it's just the type of training that they can learn from one group to another. Dave might know a lot more about this. Libby might as well. So I could be incorrect with it, but I feel like dogs are, and this could come back to the breeding that Sam was just talking about, they are more bred for these behaviors. Sheepdog. You can tell a sheepdog to go do something with a sheep, not do something, to go herd the sheep, to walk with you, to stop, to walk with you, to sit, whatever, and they'll do it because that's what they've learned. Our cats sit when there's food in front of them because they know they're going to get it.
Right.
I have to give enormous credit to Libby for training them to do that because I don't know how the fuck she did it. It's really fun. It's a great party trick. Whenever our friends come over, we say, hey, watch this, sit, and they do it. But it's only if there's food in their face. So these cats maybe are just following creepy archive lady to where they're going to eat because they know they're about to eat. If you have a cat that is used to eating at a certain time, you know they'll just sit by where they're going to eat and stare at you for the hour leading up to their food because they know it's coming.
Actually, Sam and I lived with a man who had trained his cat. So John trained his cat to poop in the toilet, a feature which he instantaneously regretted because the cat couldn't use the toilet to flush. So he was just constantly in this state of having to deal with cat turds floating around in his toilet.
Yep.
I'd forgotten that there was a cat as well because I love Luca so much, the dog.
The behaviorist who had taught us during school used to refer to, there were three things that you had to remember when training cats. So one, repetition is key. Behaviors can be lost very quickly. If you're not regularly doing it and training it and reinforcing it, the cat will lose the behavior. Two, negative reinforcement is really bad. Cats will turn on you rapidly for punishment and other attempts to try and like set a behavior in place. And three, cats have a very short attention span. You have to break up training. And I remember a buddy of mine in the class and sitting there, and he's like, well, fuck you. This sounds like training a psychopathic ADHD teenager where you just have to know, like, at any minute they could get bored and go set your car on fire if you dare yell at them.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you can train cats. My cats in this house were trained to sit quietly when I used to cut their nails. And they were also trained to jump up from the ground into my arms, which was a great party trick. When my partner came along and decided that she didn't want to continue to reinforce those traits, I now have two cats who can be assholes while cutting their nails. And I have two cats that are far too lazy to jump into their arms because they're like, fuck you, she picks us up. Why the fuck would we do that?
No.
Yeah. No.
On that,
I do worry that the French Ministry of Magic, it would just take one bad day of the cat trainer not doing his job, and these things would be like, yeah, we're fucking off now.
Interesting story with Ashes, the gray cat you just saw. I was home alone at my apartment one time, and the shape of the apartment is the bathroom is in the bedroom, but you have to go through the bathroom in order to get to the bedroom first. And there's no other entrance to the bedroom. So I was sitting alone. I lived with my sister at the time, but she wasn't there. She was in class. I was sitting alone in my bedroom doing my homework. And all of a sudden I hear in my bathroom someone pissing in the toilet. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, there's an intruder in my house. So I grab like a bat or some kind of, you know, shitty weapon that won't serve me well at all. And I sneak around to the bathroom. And there is Ashes sitting on the toilet, pissing in the toilet. Which I have never taught her to do. And since has done that two other times on separate occasions. I toyed with the idea of training her to do it. But like Dave said, I thought about cat turds just constantly floating in the toilet. And I thought, no.
Yeah. I remember Jonathan explaining to me when I was asking him about that. And I was like, oh, it's not that bad. Like the cat turds floating in the toilet. And he's like, motherfucker, you've only smelled cat turds when they've hit the cat litter and kind of been riped up and like thrown shit over. He's like, you know how those things smell if they're just sitting there floating wet and fuming into the entire apartment all day?
Gross.
Like a shitty tea bag in your toilet steeping all
right,
day.
Right, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I can smell it now just talking about this. Ugh, God.
And while we're on this note, I will just say that Newt Scamander actually describes the Zau as a big kitten, saying that it's not harmless, it's just misunderstood, it's a big kitten. A kitten that size would be horrifying, so scary.
Absolutely.
Cats are sociopaths, and they learn that behavior from a very early age. So one that size, no, I'm not going near it. It'd kill me just for fun.
Plus one that's been mistreated.
Yeah, exactly. Terrifying.
Thank God he has the bell.
Yeah.
Scientists found that cats know when their owners say their names, but they don't give a care enough to do anything about it, because science says they don't love you.
It is time for another class in Literature 101. This time I want to talk about taking a big steamy dump. Info dump, that is. We are first going to look at exposition and storytelling, and I'm just using Wiki here for some basic definitions. So I want to talk about narrative exposition. Narrative exposition is the insertion of background information into a story. Basically, anytime a reader is provided a character or world history, prior plot events, things of that nature, it can be essential in fiction to provide the reader with a sense of realism, a fully formed world with history motivations for characters, or understanding the storyline. Exposition in and of itself is obviously a very good thing. Now, in reference to today's movie, I'm going to teach what not to do and what to do when it comes to exposition in a story. So I will try to keep this brief. What not to do. An information dump or exposition dump, this is literally the term, I'm not making this up, is a large and sudden heaping helping of expositional information by the author to provide background or context when they deem it necessary to be able to continue the plot. This is often an ill-advised technique for the narrative, especially when used in dialogue, as it slows down the plot or breaks immersion for the readers. It's clunky, it's chunky, and it makes the readers feel a bit funky. The end of this movie is an excellent example of an info dump. So you have Leta Lestrange talking for 10 minutes, as we've established, in a tomb to explain one thing and one thing only, the plot to the viewers. It's so long, in fact, that in order to fill time, the studio had to film a Titanic-sized scene just so the audience would have something to look at while she talked. So if you think about that, all that film of her on the ship as a little girl and like with the baby, they literally had to do that because she would just be talking to this room. So it's a very visual way to understand what the author or the screenplay writer is doing here, which is just piling on story in one scene.
Yeah. And I think the most gratuitous part of it is that there's another story directly before hers. Like, Yusuf Karma talks for 5 minutes and he's like, this is what happens. We go, oh, okay, that's exposition. And she's like, no, actually, this is what happened.
Yeah, because he has his own scene.
It's 10, maybe 15% of the movie.
Yeah.
It is a great example of what not to do. Now, what to do is called indirect exposition, or sometimes called incluing, and it's a technique of world building in which the reader is gradually exposed to background information about the world in which the story is set. The idea is to clue the readers into the world the author is building without them being aware of it. So this can be done a number of ways, through dialogues, flashbacks, character thoughts, background details, in-universe media, a narrator telling a backstory. I mean, there's so many examples of the right way to do this. I won't go into it. If you guys have some, you can throw them out.
You're talking about examples like John Wick, not doing a, just slowly building into the world, seeing the characters, but not having someone sit down and be like, the hotel was built in 1900.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just revealed to the viewers or the readers, and you kind of understand the world as you're experiencing the world. And that is the best way to adjust your audience to the world that you've created, rather than just, as Adam was saying, tell them. And I'll talk about show don't tell here in a second.
I feel like this is also just like a real hallmark of Harry Potter films in general. Like, think the enormous pub scene in the third one where Harry finds out that that Sirius Black, you know, killed his parents.
A little bit of history, which I thought was kind of neat. Indirect exposition was first clearly identified in at least the modern literary world from the writings of Rudyard Kipling, who, if you know who that is, he wrote The Jungle Book. So in his stories like The Jungle Book, he was faced with the problem of Western readers not really understanding the culture or environment of India. So he gradually developed the technique of explaining through example. The Jungle Book was relatively subtle compared to his later works in science fiction, where he used the technique much more obviously and necessarily to explain an entirely fantastic world unknown to any reader in his Aerial Board of Control universe.
What I've heard of.
That's a hell of a name for a series.
Love the idea of, I'm world building India.
But I mean, it makes sense because at that time, you know, he didn't have as much travel or news or anything like that. There was not as many photographs even to help you kind of understand. A lot of people read about elephants, but they never saw what one looked like. So you really had to explain it as a different, universe, as we think of with these fictional universes. As Adam said, show, don't tell is often a phrase writers hear and remind themselves of when they're writing, at least if you're good. It is a writing technique that allows readers to experience the story through actions, words, thoughts, senses, and feelings, rather than through author's exposition, summarization, and description. Writing is obviously, I always have a phrase, I think everybody has at least one book in them. I think, though, whenever you're writing fictional worlds, you really have to understand the craft of writing. And it's not an easy thing. I think that so often as writers, we get marginalized as it's like, oh, like, yeah, you can just write a book. And if you ever sit down to do it, it's a very difficult thing to do and to do well.
It's one of those things that Libby and I were talking about the other day where, to her point, this is a very difficult thing to get right and it takes a lot of work. And we take it for granted, not only as people not understanding what goes into writing, but also as someone who takes that media in. Because when it works, it's just like, oh yeah, it's a world and they're in it. And you don't notice it. I understand what this is. But then when it doesn't work, Harry Potter, it's very obvious and it really takes you out.
Some really good examples of indirect exposition in books are a book that I've talked about before, The Wind-Up Girl, and a book that I've been going on so much about recently, The Priory of the Orange Tree. They have fantastic kind of bits where they just throw you into this world, they throw these terms at you, and you come to understand exactly what they mean really naturally over the course of the book. And I don't think that, you know, they don't have massive expo dumps anywhere. And they're really interesting worlds too, so I highly recommend either of those two.
Audiences can sniff out bad exposition from miles away. All it takes is announcing a character's entire MO right out of the gates.
This is Katana. She's got my back. She can cut all you in half with one sword stroke, just like mowing the lawn.
So, as with last week, I think we can safely say that we feel bad for all these creatures in some way. So, which of them do we feel the worst for?
Antonio!
It's kind of a gimme this week, isn't it? The Kelpie seems to be doing fine in his underwater lair. The Zalwu is, you know, he's been released and he's taken care of now.
Free now.
And the Matagawa, they're well employed. They're not getting fired anytime soon.
Yeah, I feel like...
cute Antonio.
So needy.
Antonio probably got the rawest deal of all these movies until we saw the newest movie. So stay tuned for that next weekend. Yeah.
So would we recommend this movie?
Let me think.
Would you recommend it if the third one had been really good? Spoiler alert for next week. We don't think it is.
Go ahead, Adam.
I feel like the only way I could recommend this is with a bunch of caveats of, are you a massive fan of Harry Potter and you have to partake in every piece of the media related to that franchise? Yes, watch it. Do you not really care about Harry Potter? Don't watch this.
Do you love Zoe Kravitz and want to hear her just talk for 10 minutes in a row? In which case, go and watch Batman instead.
Yeah.
Dave, you looked a little torn on whether or not you'd recommend this movie, actually.
No, I would definitely not recommend this movie. The background of this film with the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial going on is the only thing that I would maybe be like, it's slightly interesting to just see him existing in both of those worlds. But it's not worth watching the film.
No. Yeah. And I really hate how much they forced Fantastic Beasts into this. Because I think in the next film that we'll talk about next week, it feels somewhat better integrated. In this film, it feels very, very forced. And the first film should have been The Hobbit to The Wizarding War trilogy.
Yes.
They really should have just made a sharp departure. Because Fantastic Beasts does not make any sense anymore.
Nope, it does not. On that lovely end note, next week we'll be coming back with Fantastic Beasts 3, The Secrets of Dumbledore.
Dumbledore's Secrets.
The Secretions of Dumbledore. Fantastic Leaks fantastic. And Where to Find Them, The Secretions of Dumbledore. There we go. There's one for next week.
So as we say here at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
I can't move against Grindelwald. It has to be you. In your shoes, I'd probably refuse to. It's late. Good evening, Newt.
Oh, come on.